Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymere Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymere.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at Graymere Church of Christ.
It is a blessing to be together tonight to worship, and I know we have several guests with us. We did this morning, I think we had 599. But if you're a preacher doing a preacher count, you get to round that up. So we had approximately 600 this morning. If it's a real preacher count, you'd get up towards 620 or 630. But we're glad that everybody was here, and we're glad that you're here tonight. We heard two outstanding lessons from Bruce McLarty that were encouraging and uplifting for us, and we're in for that again tonight. Just a reminder, we will have a meal after this worship service, and even if you're here tonight and you weren't planning on staying, we hope that you'll stay. We'll have plenty of food, and we want to get to know you and find out some ways that we can encourage you. I mentioned this morning the fact that Bruce has preached in congregational settings for years, most recently at the college church for 14 years, before going over to the campus of Harding University to work as Dean of Bible and then as Vice President of Spiritual Life, and beginning in June of 2013, assumed the role of President of Harding University. And so this has been a busy year for him, and he's made time to be with us, and we're grateful for that. I neglected to mention some of the writing that he has done that have blessed many people, not just articles in things like Gospel Advocate, but also commentary on the book of Philemon that's part of the Truth for Today series, and other commentary on John. Those are books we have in our library and have blessed a lot of people, and so we're excited to have him with us. We're also thankful that he'll be staying for our preaching workshop that's tomorrow. And again, on behalf of all those who are going to be participating, thank you as a congregation for making that possible for us. We're looking forward to that as well. And so without taking up any more of his time, we'll ask Bruce to come and share a message with us.
Thank you, Andrew. Please open your Bibles to Matthew chapter 10. Matthew chapter 10 is a text we'll begin with here in just a moment. Once again, I want to say it's wonderful to be with you. I appreciate the invitation. Look forward to the events of tomorrow, and I thoroughly enjoy today. It's good to get to be at Graymere. It's good to get to be with Andrew and his family, and I'm so proud of him and of the ministry that he's doing and the leadership for already seeking to pass on the faith to the next generation. Tonight we want to talk about how is it that we love others best. All of us are in relationship. We're here tonight because we're in relationship to one another because of our relationship with God. We're in families. We're in homes. We seek to know how it is that we can best love others. And tonight we open our Bibles, we turn to the Word of God in search of that. I want to begin in an unusual place this evening. There was a book that a friend gave me a year or two ago about Amish peace. It was, if I can catch up with myself there we go. It's a book that's written by someone who's not Amish, but she's quite sympathetic to their way of life and fascinated by them, studying the Amish up in Pennsylvania, and their little 2- and 3-page reflections. And I found it to be just incredibly challenging. I think maybe my initial interest is because my wife is from the Amish part of Ohio. When I went home with her the first time, it's the first time I had ever seen a hitching post at a Walmart. And I thought that was just really unusual. And when the buggies would come up and down the street in front of her house, and I'd hear the clop, 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 clop of the horse hooves, I'd always jump up and run to the window like it was something that had never happened before. And her family thought that was kind of curious because for them in that part of Ohio, it's just sort of a way of life. In the book, there were a number of things that I found fascinating. One of them was a chapter about the Amish and their scooters. And you know how that the Amish in Pennsylvania dress very much in black and white and gray, not in bright colors at all. But as you go by their barns, sometimes the writer was saying, you'll see little scooters, not engine-powered scooters, but foot-powered scooters that are maybe a neon blue. And you think, what is going on here? I didn't realize, but evidently, back in the early part of the 20th century, when pedal bicycles became very common, the Amish had something of a crisis. Are we going to accept the pedal bicycle or not? And Amish elders all over the country were wrestling with this big, divisive issue. Most of them eventually decided not to go with pedal bicycles, but they would allow scooters like this. And so the writer of the book, Suzanne Woods Fisher, says that you'll commonly see an Amish father dressed all in black, maybe with his little boy dressed all in black behind him, going on the scooter down to the local market to get something that mom needs for supper. And the reason that they went with scooters but banned the bicycle is this. They said with the pedal bicycle, it's going to be far too easy to get too far from home. I find their reasoning fascinating. Too easy to get too far from home. Because you see, they run every decision through two sieves. One is the question about how would this affect the family? And the other is, how would this affect our faith? Not two bad questions at all. How would this affect the family? And how would this affect the faith? There was one section about Amish proverbs, and there are a number of really good proverbs. This one I love. He who has no money is poor. He who has nothing but money is even poorer. But the thing that was most striking to me in the book, and the thing that was most convicting, and the thing that launches us into tonight's lesson, was a chapter about the Amish and their children. The first paragraph is what stunned me. Listen closely. Amish children are loved, but not adored. They are wanted, but not made to feel special. They are provided for, but not spoiled. Doesn't that just almost sound like 21st century heresy? Doesn't that sort of shake us a little bit? Doesn't that make us wince and think, now, I think I can remember hearing myself say something that sounds almost the opposite of this. Amish children are loved, but not adored. I have to admit, when I first read this, I thought back of times that I have used the expression adored and how I absolutely adore someone. I remember preaching a funeral of a man at the college church. And every Sunday morning, he got there really early. And so I would always walk up to him because he always had some quip or some insult for me that day. And I'd go and take his best shot. And after that, the day was a lot easier. And if he didn't have something new or original, he would always take my tie in his hand and he'd say, "I see you've been in the attic again." It was something along that line just every Sunday. As I was preaching his funeral, I said, "You know, everybody said that if Stan loved you, he gave you a hard time." And I said, "Then Stan must have adored me because of the time he gave me." I use the word adore oftentimes to speak of things like my grandchildren. It's easy for me to talk about how I just absolutely adore them. And then this statement, Amish children are loved, but are not adored. And I kind of wrestled with that a little bit. And I wondered about the wording. I decided to go to a dictionary and just see, okay, what does this word adore mean in the dictionary? It means to worship as God or a God. Ooh. Now, if that's what's being talked about, then what's said in that book makes a whole lot of sense. Of course, it can also mean to regard with deep, often rapturous love. Something that is, we would expect to find in Song of Solomon, about how someone adores their beloved. Or simply it can be diluted down into to like very much. As an intransitive verb, simply adore can simply mean to worship. So, what about children? Is it appropriate to adore our children? Or is there something about that opening paragraph in that chapter that ought to in some way convict us? Well, I think I know what it is that we are being drawn toward here. There was a movie last year, The Hunger Games. I remember being in a theater with my wife before this came out and seeing the trailer to this movie. And I remember after seeing the basic storyline, I leaned over to my wife and I said, "I don't think so." A little bit later, I was with a group of college students, about 25 of us in a Bible study. And the movie was coming out and I said, "How many of you have read The Hunger Games?" Every hand in the room. And most of them had read all three books. I thought, well, I better find out about this. And I think one of the powerful things in this is this primary character, this 16-year-old girl named Katniss Everdeen, who is a part of a family in what looks very much like what used to be Appalachia. And it's in this post-apocalyptic world where there is this unthinkable game that goes on that is televised for everybody's entertainment. These districts that are still being punished for a civil war sometime back in the past, each one of these districts has to do a drawing. And one boy and one girl are selected from each district. And they are treated wonderfully and they are prepared and then they are put together in a fight to the death on television. It's a horrible, horrible, unthinkable scene. Well, this girl goes with her sister and Katniss' little sister, 12-year-old Primrose, is the one that year that is drawn. And she steps up and she says, Katniss does, she says, "I volunteer as tribute," which is another way of saying, "I will take my sister's place. I will go to the Hunger Games." I think every parent here tonight knows what that feeling is like. I think every one of us knows that we would willingly lay down our lives for our children. And now that I have grandchildren, it's just not even a question. I would do that in a heartbeat. We would lay down our lives for them, but does it mean that we adore them? There's a story that's told by Tony Campolo from something he experienced about 25 years ago. He was preaching for a church somewhere in the Northeast, and a friend of his called up one day and said, "I'm supposed to be on this television show on Sunday. And it's a rabbi and a preacher, and it's always just a discussion about some religious topic. And this Sunday, it's going to be on family. I can't be there. Would you fill in for me?" And Campolo thought, what could be easier than sitting down and talking about family? Everybody is for it, aren't they? Well, he shows up at the studio, and he sits down, and the thing gets started. The lights come on. They're on the air. And the first thing that the rabbi says is, "Well, I guess the biggest difference is Judaism is very pro-family and Christianity is very anti-family." And Campolo thinks, "I should have prepared more because I'm not ready for this kind of a brawl. Judaism is very pro-family. Christianity is very anti-family. What is being described here?" Well, let's look at some passages. I think all of this, maybe this evening, prepares us to think about and maybe to hear some of the text in the New Testament that we don't typically think very much about. First of all, in Matthew chapter 10, Jesus says one of the strangest things. When I was in graduate school, I wrote a paper in a Gospels class that dealt with these texts. And I remember thinking just how difficult this stuff is, because it seems to run counter to so much of what we see in Jesus, and it runs counter very much to what we encounter in church and what we encounter in a lot of Christian literature. Verse 34 of Matthew chapter 10, Jesus says this, "Do not suppose that I have come to bring peace on the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I have come to turn a man against his father and a daughter against her mother. A daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's enemies will be the members of his own house. Anyone who loves his father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Anyone who loves his son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And anyone who does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Whoever finds his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. Doesn't that sound brutal? Jesus talking about how there is a sense in which he comes to bring peace. We know it was announced at his birth. And yet there is a sense in which Jesus says, I didn't come to bring peace. I came to bring a sword. And the truth of the matter is that in some families, the faith is going to be a very tense and divisive issue. And your allegiance to me might very well divide you from the closest relationships in your life. And yet today, I think in our culture, we just have a hard time even hearing that. Because loving family and loving Jesus have been so combined that it's hard to even separate those ideas anymore. Let's turn in our Bibles to the Gospel of Luke. In the Luke chapter 12, where Jesus picks up the same idea again. In Luke chapter 12, picking up in verse 49, Jesus says this, I've come to bring fire on the earth, and how I wish it were already kindled. For I have a baptism to undergo, and how distressed I am until it is completed. Do you think that I came to bring peace on the earth? No, I tell you, not peace, but division. From now on there will be five in one family, divided against each other. Three against two and two against three. They will be divided. Father against son and son against father. Mother against daughter and daughter against mother. Mother-in-law against daughter-in-law and daughter-in-law against mother-in-law. Again, isn't that a brutal teaching? Isn't it hard for us to hear that Jesus says that from now on, because of Him, there are going to be some families that are going to be divided three and two because of Jesus. And then there's that text back in the Gospel of Matthew. If you'll turn back there to Matthew chapter 12. At the end of the chapter, we find that Jesus is busy teaching and he's surrounded by people, and he's in the midst of the crowd. His mother and his brothers come to take him back home. In verse 46, while Jesus was still talking to the crowd, his mother and his brothers stood outside wanting to speak to him. Someone told him, your mother and your brothers are standing outside wanting to speak to you. But he replied to him, who is my mother and who are my brothers? Pointing to his disciples, he said, here are my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother and sister and mother. I've preached that text a number of times. I have found it very comforting in a lot of other times. The idea that as we look at each other tonight, as we look around this room tonight, and we realize that whatever our relationship with our brothers and sisters and mothers and fathers in the flesh, that in this room, don't we have family? Haven't we found brothers and sisters and mothers and fathers? I've been blessed by so many in my life. But going back just before we go to the point where we talk about ourselves and the comfort we get from this and all that, imagine being Mary that day. Imagine being the brothers of Jesus that day. And you can't get inside the house, and you send word to one person who tells another, another to another, and it gets all the way up to Jesus. Your mother and your brothers are out here wanting to talk to you. And then for Jesus to say, who is my mother? And who are my brothers? And from one person to another, to another, to another, to the ears of Mary, Jesus said, who is my mother? Can you feel how brutal that would be? I'll guarantee you that every mother who's in here tonight is thinking about how it would break your heart for a child to say something like that about you. And for the brothers, I can just imagine how they're thinking, who do you think you are? Jesus, you've kind of gotten full of yourself. Who are my brothers? What do you think? And yet Jesus is saying something so important in terms of the kingdom. About in the kingdom of God, the people who do the will of the Father, that's our deepest family. Those are the people that are our new family in the kingdom of God. Stay with me for a moment. Let's turn our Bibles over to John chapter 19, where I think this may be the ultimate family passage in the life and the story of Jesus. Picking up in verse 25, in the middle of the crucifixion scene, John says, catch up with myself here. John says, near the cross of Jesus stood his mother's sisters, Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. When Jesus saw his mother there and the disciple whom he loved standing nearby, he said to his mother, dear woman, here is your son. And to the disciple, he said, here is your mother. And from that time on, the disciple took her into his home. Once again, this is a passage that I have found to be incredibly tender. And I've gone to a number of times looking at how much Jesus cared for his mother. And while he's dying there on the cross, he looks out and has compassion on her. And his heart is filled with her needs. I don't know about you, but when I hurt, I become very self-absorbed. When I hurt, it's hard to think about anything or anybody else. It's just sort of a natural tendency of being a person. Jesus is dying on the cross, and he turns to his mother and takes care of her in the aftermath of what is happening there on the cross. Son, behold your mother. Woman, behold your son. John takes her into his home, and she's cared for the rest of her life. And yet, once again, back up just a bit. And especially every woman in here tonight. Think about what it would have been like to have been there at the foot of the cross and Jesus is dying. It's the ultimate nightmare. It's the thing that you most cannot take into your heart. You can't absorb this. It is something that you fear incredibly. You fear deeply. And here is your son dying on the cross. And I wonder if, in spite of her best efforts, I wonder if Mary might not even have thought, can we dare to say this? That Mary might even have thought, how can you do this to me? You were so stubborn about coming to Jerusalem. You were so relentless about speaking what you spoke in the presence of the powers. And here you are dying on the cross, and I know it's what you think you ought to do, but don't you know you're killing me? How could you do this to me? And then as you and I back up and we look at this scene, we think about as much as she is hurting and as much as she may even be hurting because Jesus is, what he's doing is killing her. As Jesus dies on the cross, he is saving her soul. He's saving her soul. It hurts like everything, and it looks like he's abandoned her. It looks like he has gone his way, and now he's leaving her. How could you do this? But you and I know that as he dies on the cross, he is saving his own mother's soul. Though it may feel like everything else in the world to him. I believe that we love others best when we love God the most. I think that's what Jesus shows us at the cross. I think that's what Jesus speaks to us when he talks about all that division and how that sometimes there are going to be people who are going to be divided because of the gospel of Jesus Christ. That he is saying, you know how you can love people the very best? You love people best when we love God the most. It was summer a year ago. I got to hear a man named John Clayton. I'd heard about this man much of my life. I'd intersected with him a number of different ways, but I'd never heard him before. And I went to hear him one night at the spiritual growth workshop down in Orlando. I'd heard about him earlier because one of my elders at the college church years earlier, when he was at the University of Indiana, that he had been preaching for a church there in town. And John Clayton was a young college student, young graduate student. He started dating one of the girls in the church. John Clayton was a knucklehead. He was just a difficult person just to be in the room with. You see, he had been raised by parents who were militant atheists. His father had grown up in the home of a minister of some faith. And his father talked the faith all the time, but he was a hard and unloving man. And so when this boy got big enough, when John Clayton's father got big enough, he left home and he wanted nothing more to do with anything that had to do with God. He found this woman to marry, John Clayton's mother, who had been orphaned at the age of 8. And she went to live with an aunt who spoke about things of faith all the time. And yet, when his mother was a teenager, this woman swindled her out of all of her inheritance. Two people who were bitter about religion by the time they got grown, and so they married each other. They fed off of each other's cynicism, and they were determined that they were going to be an atheistic household and raise atheistic sons. And that they did. One of them was their son, John. John falls in love with a girl who is a Christian, and she comes to church, brings him to church, and he would have discussions with this girl, and sometimes she wasn't able to answer the questions. And so they would go and they would talk to the preacher. Ray Muncy was his name. One of my elders at the college church in my earliest days there. Long time head of our history department at Harding. Well, one night, the girl's not there at church. It's a Sunday night like this. The girl's not there at church, and John Clayton comes by himself. And at the end of the sermon, they stood to sing the invitation song. And John Clayton steps out and he walks down the aisle. Ray Muncy told me years later, he said he almost backed into the baptistry because his first thought was, John Clayton's coming forward to punch me in the mouth. He thought that was what was about to happen. What he didn't realize was that John had come that night to become a Christian. And he wanted to do it without her there because he wanted it to be a decision he made not to please her, but because he had come to the point in life where he no longer could be a person who was antagonistic to the belief in God. Well, as years go by, there's family estrangement. His family pretty much regards him as dead. When he became a Christian, it did divide that family. Years go by. One of the ironies of life is that his father had died and his mother had had a stroke. Because of a number of factors, his mother came to live with John and his wife. The son who had been shunned because of the faith, the mother comes to live with that son and his wife. John told us that night in Orlando, he said one night he was changing his mother's diaper. And she said to him, John, your brothers wouldn't do this for me. And John said, oh, Mom, my brothers aren't Christians. And she said, I don't want to be an atheist anymore. We love others best when we love God most. We may live in a world where it seems like if we make our marriage the greatest good in our lives, that that's the thing to do, but that's not Christian, and those are not the words of Jesus. We may think that if we adore our children and we make them the centerpiece of our lives, that that's how we can love our children best, and that's a devil's lie. The way we love husband or wife, brother or sister, son or daughter, grandson or granddaughter best, is when we love God most. And then we are free to love in a way and to a degree that we never, ever before imagined. The message tonight is from the words of Jesus that we love others best when we love God most. So we're going to offer the invitation tonight. And the invitation is not come to Jesus and He's going to make all your relations easy. That's not true. The invitation is you are called. I am called. We are all called to come and make Him Lord of our lives. And that nothing and nobody rivals that. And in terms of adoring, we adore Him and no other. We worship Him and no other. And then adoring Him, worshiping Him, then He will teach us to love in a way we've never loved before. And the world will be a better place. And our families will be a richer place. Because we love Him most of all. This evening, are you ready to make that kind of commitment? If you are not yet a child of God, our invitation to you, the invitation of Jesus, is not an easy invitation. Tonight, I'm really not soft-selling it, am I? I'm not saying that it's going to be easy. I'm not saying that it doesn't have to mess up anything else in your life. Not at all. I'm saying He has to become Lord of all. Are you ready to become a child of God? Are you ready to be baptized into Christ tonight? That's the commitment you're making. Or this evening you may have some burden. Some burden that is weighing down on you heavily. And it may have to do with things at home. Your mother and your brothers and your new family in Christ, the people who gathered here tonight, are people to whom you can bring such a burden and who will make it better. This evening, if you're subject to the invitation, we invite you to adore Jesus Christ, to worship Him only, and to give your life to Him. And if you need to do that this evening, won't you do so as we stand and sing?